This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his teaching on proverb pairs and the Proverbs 26, 4 and 5, quote, contradiction, end quote. Session 1, to answer or not to answer a fool. That is the question. Welcome today to the presentation for Biblical e-learning on proverb pairs and the Proverbs 26 verses 4 and 5, quote, contradiction, to answer or not to answer a fool. And so we're going to be talking about proverb pairs today and going into quite a bit of detail here as we do this presentation on Proverbs. Get this thing going here. The questions that we'll be addressing basically are Proverbs in chapters 10 to 29, just isolated units of Proverbs thrown together in a haphazard manner? Or is there some discernible and meaningful editorial ordering of the Proverbs in these sentence Proverbs, as they're called, in chapters 10 to 29? Is there ordering? And if there is ordering, how does that ordering function? In other words, what triggers it? How can we discover it and things? And what is the meaning behind it that the editors, why they put such and such a proverb next to the other proverb? What are the hermeneutical benefits of observing this interproverbial contextual connections? In other words, the connections between the sentences. What is the interpretive or hermeneutical benefit of that? Are proverbs just boring, banal platitudes reflecting a black and white retribution principle of act and consequence, which affirms the status quo or tradition, contra Job and Ecclesiastes, which are much more sophisticated, quote, wisdom literature, if you still use that term? So we'll be looking at, for example, in Proverbs chapter 12, let me just read that. Proverbs chapter 12, verses 21, kind of shows this kind of cut and dry kind of thing. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 21 says this: no harm overtakes the righteous, but the wicked have their fill of trouble. So you have kind of a character, the righteous, and no harm overtakes the righteous. So you have righteous, and then you have a consequence. You have the wicked, but the wicked have their fill of trouble. And so this is called like the retribution principle, and a lot of people view that as being very banal and straightforward black and white world, reflecting a black and white world. Now, we're going to be stressing the context then of these two proverbial sentences and putting them back to back and how they connect with one another, and if they do connect one another, or whether it's just a haphazard mix. But context is important. When you study the meaning of words, context determines meaning. And so, for example, let me just use an English example, the word trunk. What does the word trunk mean? Well, context determines meaning. So if I say trunk, what comes to your mind? Well, for many of us, tree trunk comes to mind. But for others who are traveling now or trying to travel, it's luggage trunk that you travel with. Some people are driving in their car and they have a car trunk. A car trunk is very different from a tree trunk. And so you see that as soon as you put a word next to it, all of a sudden the word trunk takes on different nuances, different meanings. The body trunk. And then you have the elephant's trunk. Very different. A rail line, they call those a trunk, a rail line trunk. And then even now in the digital world, we have a network trunk line, which is a big line, and it's called a trunk. And so therefore, what the meaning of trunk is, you say, it's trunk. It really depends on the context, the words that go with it, whether it's a car trunk, a tree trunk, or a body trunk, or an elephant trunk, or whatever. Genres, literary genres, or types of literature also affect how you interpret things. So, for example, let's just say you pick up a newspaper. Does anybody remember what that is, a newspaper? Anyways, they used to have these things called newspapers that people would pick up. And on the front page, you had certain types of photographs and also certain types of stories made it to the front page. And so when you pick up a newspaper, you expect a certain type of story to be placed on the front page. On the other hand, as you get into the newspaper, you have an editorial page. An editorial page in which people are giving their opinions on everything. And so therefore you know that this may not even be done by the newspaper themselves, but this may be an editorial coming in from outside that's just somebody bloviating about their opinion, good or bad. You have a cartoon page. And so when you pick up a cartoon page, you don't expect to get the same thing that you would get on a front page. A cartoon page. There's also classified ads. You look in the back and you're trying to buy a new car, you're trying to buy, you know, something new for your house, and so you look in the classified ads, or you're trying to hire somebody, you look in the classified ads at the back of the paper. Notice the front page different from the back with the classified ads. You aren't going to put the classified ads on the front page. And then other things like obituaries. You look at obituaries, what are you expecting to get? Well, it's going to tell you who in the area has died and give some history and background of their life and what they did and possibly a picture of them. And so obituaries are very different than a front page story. It's different than an editorial. It's different than cartoons. It's different than classified ads. And so these all take, in a newspaper, would take a different place, a different role, a different ordering in that newspaper. Now, documentaries, for example, are very different than fictional stories. And so if you're looking at a movie or something, my wife and I sit down to watch a movie, and it's fictional, we expect one type of thing. When it's science fiction, for example, it's a little bit different than just plain fictional story. And that's very different than when we watch a documentary. So the type of literature that you're watching or listening to affects what you expect. So we'll be seeing, what do we expect from a proverb? How does a proverb, the fact that it is a proverb, how does that affect its meaning and affect its truth, for example? Biblical genres also, this applies to the Bible as well. So we know for in a historical narrative, you're going to hear stories about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, and you know Esau, and Moses, and Aaron, and things like that, and Joshua, and various things, Samuel, and David, and the various kings, Hezekiah, and Jehoiakim, or whatever. And so in the historical narratives, you're getting a historical, and it's telling you about individuals, where they lived, and what they did. And so you get plots, you get beginnings and ends of a story, and you get the middle or climax of a story, and the stories proceed, historical narrative kinds of things. That's different than a prophetic utterance, where a prophet comes in and says, basically, repent, you know, shuv, repent, and so therefore the prophetic narratives are different. They say, thus saith the Lord, whereas the historical narratives will tell you that, you know, David did all these things that were really kind of nasty at times and things. You say, how did David really did that? And how do you understand it? Some of the, you have to interpret historical narratives in a certain way. In the prophets, you've got a thus saith the Lord, and then the man or woman speaks a prophecy from God. Okay, and then you watch the people's response, the audience's response to the prophetic message. They usually beat them up, threw them in prison or a septic tank or something like that. And so the prophets had a pretty rough time. But then you hear some of the story of the prophets, these people of God who spoke the word of God to the community there. Psalms are very different than both prophets and the historical narrative, even though you have psalmic elements in both those types of genre. But psalms and parables, the kingdom of heaven is like. And you know then you're going to get a story about, of a sower who goes out to sow seed, and some falls on the road, and some falls in the rocks, and some actually produces good stuff. And so parables, the kingdom of heaven is like, it's kind of like in English we would say once upon a time, as I read a story to my granddaughters or grandson, and you'd say once upon a time. As soon as you say once upon a time, it triggers a type of expectation of what type of story you're getting. So the kingdom of heaven is like parables. Apocalyptic literature, and obviously John and Daniel, Ezekiel, those things, and the prophet sees something, and he sees something in the future. and he sees something that's relevant for their time, and so you expect certain types of thing and kind of even in modern terms, in terms of Apocalypse Now. And you expect some kind of end of the world type of thing and a polarization of good and evil and these heavenly scenes and earthly consequences. In Psalms, you get laments, you get Psalms of praise, you get Psalms of ascent. So even within the genre of Psalms, you have laments, praise, Psalms of ascent and various types of Psalms, imprecations and other things like that. In Proverbs, you get Proverbs, okay? And so we need to look at how do Proverbs function. Proverbs are pretty much an international phenomenon. They occur in almost every language around the world. And so Proverb, how does a proverb function within its culture and within its literary genre? Form and meaning are connected. Form and meaning are connected. And so the literary form is going to shape what types of things are communicated and how they're communicated. Okay, so we're just wanting to say that. Now, genre does matter. Let's take, for example, historical. The word locus, okay, so you hear the word locus in the Bible. If you're in the historical narrative and all of a sudden you've got locusts, it was a plague in Egypt. And so God, what do you see? The locusts come in and swarm over the land of Egypt and eat up all the food. And what it shows is it reveals God's mighty hand as he takes his people out of slavery and delivers them and leads them to the promised land. And so the locusts then are an evidence or revelation of God in the historical books, particularly in the book of Exodus, the early chapters there. In the prophetic literature, you've got, say, take the book of Joel, and he kind of specializes in locusts. And so you have different types of locusts coming as a plague on Israel. And now locusts are not a revelation of the deliverance of God, but rather locusts come as a judgment on the people of God and a kind of a precursor of the day of the Lord, of the day of the Lord. So locusts play a different, very different function in the prophetic book of Joel than they did in the book of Exodus. Then you have, of course, the apocalypse. In the book of Revelation, all of a sudden you have these pit locusts coming out, you know, the face of a man, a scorpion-like stinger on them and things. Well, you expect that. When I say apocalyptic literature, it's talking about locusts, the pit locusts is coming out of the pit. But you realize that that's, this isn't like, the locusts of Exodus or the locusts of the book of Joel. These are apocalyptic end times kind of strange things in Revelation chapter 9. Wisdom actually has locusts too. And so in the book of Ecclesiastes, you've got in terms of an old man in the book of Ecclesiastes, and this old man walking along, and he's got that old man walk. Have you ever seen somebody that's, let's say, 78 years old? Could be president of the United States. But the person who's older, and you watch how they walk, and you say, wow, that guy's got an old man walk, okay? Struggling with that myself. Anyways, but there's a certain, and so he portrays this old man using, in wisdom literature, this old man walking along, kind of like a grasshopper and things. In the New Testament, it's interesting, it takes, locusts take another flip. All of a sudden you got John the Baptist, and what does he do? He eats the locusts, okay? And so you've got different ways this locust functions then in different types of literature. Okay, and we're going to be seeing things happening in Proverbs and things like that. Now, are the sentences in Proverbs chapters 10 and following, are they thrown together haphazardly, or are they connected, and therefore we should try to discover the meaning of the relationship between the Proverbs as well as the proverb itself? A great work was done by Gerald Wilson on the Psalms, in which he went through the book of Psalms, because Psalms also had the similar type of thing, where some people said the Psalms are just thrown together, they're not really connected that much, and therefore. And he went through and developed this methodology that showed, no, the Psalms are connected to one another, and you need to read them in connection to one another. And so, for example, the editors, not only the authors who authored the Psalm, but you need to see what were the editors doing who edited the book of Psalms together. Now, David, or whoever may have been writing Psalms back at 1000 BC, but the book of Psalms also has stories and Psalms from the time of the Babylonian captivity. You know, by the waters of Babylon, we sat down, and that was 586, 587, 600 BC, rather than 1000 BC. So the book of Psalms was compiled over at least 400 years, and probably more than that. And so what we're saying is that the editor who put it together, they didn't write the Psalms necessarily, but they combined them in ways that gave new meaning because of the relationships and how they were editing them together. So we have the author's meaning, but we also have the editor's meaning and their influence in this as well. And so in the book of Psalms, for example, in Psalm 72:20, you have this statement. It's just kind of put in there, but it's the end of book two. There's five books in the Psalter. And the second book ends with this statement in Psalm 72, verse 20. This concludes the prayers of David, son of Jesse. This concludes the prayers of David, the son of Jesse. Well, now, do you realize that there are Davidic Psalms after Psalm 72? So, but what this is that we're finishing, you know, our book two, and therefore this is the end. This is how we ended. This concludes the prayers of David, the son of Jesse, to this point, and then others will be added later. In the Psalms, you also have a section of Psalms 42 to 83 that are known as the Elohistic Psalter. The Elohistic Psalter. Elohim is the name translated in your Bible, God, GOD. Okay, that's different than Yahweh, the name that's spelled YAHWEH. Yahweh, which is usually translated Lord, in all capitals, Lord, kind of a small type, but Lord, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. When you see those all capitalized, you know that the Lord there comes from Adonai, means Yahweh, that stands behind that, the name, most sacred and personal name of God, covenantal name of God in the Old Testament. Whereas Elohim, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God created Elohim. And so what's very interesting is that you have a section in Psalm 42 to 83, which is known as the Elohistic Psalter. In other words, the name Elohim comes up very strongly in chapters 42 to 83, whereas in the other chapters, the earlier books from 41 and previous, the name Yahweh is used all the time, Yahweh, Yahweh, Yahweh. And then you hit 42 to 83, and all of a sudden Elohim is used all the time. And then after 83, 84 and following, it goes back to Yahweh. Now you say, well, can you prove that? And our point isn't to argue about Psalms at this point. We've got another lecture, if you're interested, on biblical e-learning that goes through this Elohistic Psalter in detail. But it's interesting. In chapter 14, which is in the Yahweh sections, it says this. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. Their deeds are vile. There is no one who does good. The Lord, or Yahweh looks down from heaven on all mankind to see if there's anyone who understands, any who seek after God. Very interesting. That's just Psalm 14. You go over to Psalm 53, guess what you have is a duplicate psalm. And here's what Psalm 53 says. Now, Psalm 53 is in the Elohistic Psalter. Psalm 14 was in the Psalter, part of the Psalter that uses Yahweh. Psalm 53, same psalm. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. Their ways are vile. There is no one who does good. Who looks down from heaven? The other one said, the Lord looks down from heaven. But this one says, God looks down from heaven. Elohim looks down from heaven on all mankind, to see if there's anyone who understands, any who seek God. So we see here, and here's a duplicate psalm, Psalm 14, Psalm 53. In 14, it uses, the Lord looked down from heaven, and in chapter 53, the word Lord, the rest of it's almost exactly the same. The other one says, God, or Elohim looks down. So there's been a shift in the name there. That's why they call it the Elohistic Psalter. There's also Psalms of Asaph. There's a section 73 to 83. The author, however you look at that collector or whatever, from Asaph 73 to 83, you've got the Songs of Korah, which is Psalms 42 to 49. You also have the Psalms of the Ascent. And depending on how you take this word ascent, whether it's going up to Jerusalem, and these songs are sung on pilgrimage like that, but it's Psalms 120 to 134 are called the Psalms of Ascent and the going up and things. So different psalms in different sections. And so in Proverbs, you're also going to have, in Proverbs 1 to 9, you've got instructions, which are kind of instructional discourses where the father is teaching his child or son, "My son, hear my voice." And then he goes off on a story and tells them why he should listen. So, and that's 1 to 9. So those are long sections. Some of them, you know, 20, 30 verses. You get into chapter 8 on wisdom. There's a whole section on how God created and wisdom was right there kind of thing. And then chapter 9 ending with Madam Wisdom and Madam Folly inviting the young man to embrace wisdom. So those are kind of more discourse or dialogue or instructions, and they're connected longer sections. But when you hit chapter 10, all of a sudden the sentence literature takes over. In chapters 10 to 29, you have this strong sentence, one proverb after another proverb, and there kind of it goes. Let me just example, in Proverbs chapter 9, let me just take this. Wisdom has built her house. She has set up seven pillars. She has prepared her meat and mixed her wine. She has also set her table. So you get this notion that wisdom, Madam Wisdom, is preparing a meal for the young man and going to invite the young man in. This isn't just one sentence and the next sentence has nothing to do with the other. The pronouns carry this. Wisdom has built her house. And then it says, she has prepared her meat, tying into the previous verse. She has sent out her servants and she calls from the highest point in the city. Let all who are simple come to my house. To those who have no sense, she says, come, eat my food and drink the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and you will live. Walk in the way of insight. And so Madam Wisdom is inviting, and there's this whole story of her invitation. This is not sentential literature. This is not a proverb per se, and a short sentence and things. This is an instruction, chapters 1 and 9. Now, Proverbs 10, then, all of a sudden in Proverbs 10, you get this really sharp break. And then all of a sudden, boom, after chapter 10, basically 29, largely of these sentential-oriented proverbs. So, for example, in chapter 10, 1, starting that section, it says, a wise son brings joy to a father. A foolish son is a grief to his mother. Notice the parallelism there. Not the time to talk about parallelism, but to understand Hebrew poetry, you've got to understand parallelism and how it works. Then the next verse, what does the next verse say? A wise son brings joy to a father, a foolish son grief to his mother. Ill-gotten treasures are of no lasting value, but righteousness delivers from death. Now, wait a minute. What does verse 1 have to do with verse 2? You say, whoa, it's kind of not connected there. And what does verse 3 say? The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. And you say, whoa, those three proverbs are going three different directions, man. It's like a shotgun shooting out birdshot. Going all over the place. And so you say, that's interesting. Very different in terms of this sentential. It's ordered by sentences rather than these long connections and things. And in Proverbs then too, we have this statement in Proverbs 25:1 that's fairly important, really important actually. And it tells us how the book of Proverbs was put together. At one level, Proverbs 25:1 says this: "These are more proverbs of Solomon." Proverbs chapter 10:1 starts out Mishlei Shlomo, the proverbs of Solomon, and then you get chapters 10 and following. They're not, you know, I'm saying there's big debates on all these things, but anyways, chapter 25 then has it was a different section. Apparently, chapters 10 to 24 or whatever was multiple sections put together there. But then in chapter 25, it says, "These are more proverbs of Solomon compiled by the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah." So Hezekiah apparently was involved in and his people involved in chapters 25 to 29. They put those things together. And it tells us here. So I want to suggest then that there's an importance to look at what the editors were doing, not just the meaning of the original author. And who is the original author of a proverb, anyways, who offered the proverbs? Proverbs are very different than that. You say, well, Solomon did that. Well, did Solomon get those from people? Did he collect them from the Queen of Sheba and other people that came to visit him? and see his wisdom. And, you know, some of the Proverbs seem to be, well, it's a whole other story from Proverbs 22 and following, seem to be very parallel to the Proverbs of Amenemope from Egypt. So there seems to have been a big crossover between the internationalization of Proverbs. So Solomon was obviously a major collector. So Proverbs chapter 30 are the sayings of Agur. There's a guy named Agur, Proverbs chapter 30. Proverbs chapter 31 says these are the Proverbs have basically come from King for King Lemuel, that his mother taught him. And so you get now the mother teaching in Israel. And then in Proverbs 31, these aren't, Proverbs 31 are just not scattered together. In Proverbs 31, you've got the VW. You've got the virtuous woman. And in Proverbs chapter 31, the virtuous woman is an acrostic, which means it goes through the first, there's 22 verses there that are connected. The first one starts with A, the second one with B, the second one, you know, Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Daleth. In other words, in Hebrew, they go right through the alphabet. And so you have what's called an acrostic. You get to see a similar thing in Psalm 119. If you've ever looked at Psalm 119, this massive psalm, you get to see an acrostic where eight verses all begin with Aleph. Eight verses begin with Beit, and it goes through the whole alphabet, and that's why the whole thing is so honking long. It's like over 170 verses, because it's eight verses for each letter, and each psalm verse begins with that new letter. So you've got eight for each letter of the alphabet. Well, the virtuous woman in Proverbs is an acrostic, so those 22 verses are definitely connected. So whoever put that together is connecting those verses. They're not just haphazard or scattered together. Okay, so connected discourse. So what we'll show, the purpose of going over all this stuff is to show that the editors are going to build the proverbial collection together using pairs. So I'm going to suggest that Proverbs often, not always, but often come together in pairs. And you need to look at those pairs because the editors were putting those together. They wanted you to see the relationship of one verse to the next in pairs kind of thing. So this gives us a new level of meaning. We look at the authorial intent, and then we look also at the editor's intent of Scripture. So there's several insights, then hermeneutical or interpretive insights, that can be gained by this concatenation, the putting of two proverbs together. Now, proverb formation is kind of interesting. As I was reading from devotions and things, I happened to be reading in 1 Samuel, and it was interesting to me that Saul becomes king. Okay, this is 1 Samuel chapter 10. And Saul he's not made king yet. Israel's calling for a king. Samuel's all upset and says, man, the king's going to rip you off and things like that. People, they say, we don't care. We want a king and stuff. So then God says, okay, I'll give him Saul. You know, he's handsome, big, strong guy, taller than everybody else and quite an impressive young man. And so Saul's out wandering around looking for his father's donkeys. And so what happens is then Saul's going to be made king, okay, the first king of Israel kind of thing, anointed by Samuel, the last of the judges. And so here you have in chapters 10, verses 10 through 13, and what I'm looking at here is the connection between a proverb and a story, or I should say a story and a proverb, that a lot of times a proverb is a kind of like a compressed story. It's kind of like a kernel of popcorn. That, in other words, it's all come down, you apply the appropriate hermeneutical heat, and then boom, it pops up into a kernel of corn. It pops back up into a story. So proverbs and stories are connected. And here you see how a proverb was actually generated, how it actually comes into being. Now, in the book of Proverbs, you have hundreds of proverbs. You can't, you know, the book can't be long enough to have, you know, hundreds of stories. It'd be too much. But a proverb is kind of a compressed story many times. And so here you actually see how a proverb came into existence. As Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. When he and his servant arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came powerfully upon him, and he joined in their prophesying. When all those who had formerly known him saw him prophesying with the prophets, they asked each other, "What is this that has happened to the son of Kish, Saul? Is Saul among the prophets?" A man who lived there answered, "Who is their father?" So it became a saying, so it became a proverb, a saying, "Is Saul among the prophets? Do chickens have lips? Do bears sleep in the woods? Is Saul among the prophets?" Whoa, that's weird. And so it became a proverb. So the story of the Spirit of God coming on and Saul prophesying, it became a saying. And that saying then was repeated, not just for that particular historical situation, but was repeated over and over then among the folk, among the people. And it was repeated then, and it was accepted by the people. Is Saul among the prophets? And so you get this kind of thing. So I want to talk next just a little briefly about the, I want to call this a non-definition definition of a proverb. What is a proverb? Okay, what is a proverb? How does it differ from other genres of literature or oral communication? What is a proverb? There's been huge discourses on this. We'll talk about him, but one of the most famous guys in the world on proverbs, he's largely been ignored by biblical studies people to our shame. One is Archer Taylor. He's one of the guys way back that got it started. But there's a guy named Wolfgang Meter from Vermont who studied international proverbs all over the world. This guy is the leading expert in the world. I believe he is retired now. He's getting older now. But he had collected proverbs and analyzed proverbs. He's written numerous books. Wolfgang Meter on proverbs. And so he's not connected with biblical proverbs. He's dealing with universal proverbs and things, international proverbs. And so the definition has been debated in this journal called Proverbium that he was highly engaged in for decades. This Proverbium journal discussed what is a proverb. And there's all sorts of articles taken from structural points of view, sociological stance of view, rhetorical points of view, and each comes up with. And basically, one guy said, it's not worth the effort. We're trying to nail this thing down, but it's like trying to nail down jello. You know, you just can't get it nailed down. And so I'm not ready to give up just because you can't technically do one definition that covers everything. I'm not ready to give up on the idea that proverbs are different and the proverbs are unique and proverbs are their own literary genre. And so let me just give a kind of a short one. So I call this my non-definition definition, okay? Proverb is usually a short, salty, by that I mean significant, short, salty, significant, repeated, an accepted statement, often using metaphor, simile, hyperbole, generalization, and summation. So a proverb is a short, salty, significant, repeated and accepted statement. It's repeated among the folk. It's accepted in a culture that when they hear it, well, that's a proverb, they accept it. And it's often used as metaphor, simile, hyperbole, overstatement for emphasis, generalization, generalizing things, and summation, summarizing, like in the story of Saul, summarizing the story. So that's kind of the crude definition of proverbs that I'll be working with. The caution, yes, proverbs are generalizations, but you can't universalize them. A proverb is not meant to be universalized. In other words, it's not, we always talk about propositional truth. It's not a truth that fits in every circumstance and every situation. Proverb is very much the complexity of life calls for discernment, not simple guarantees where you grab a proverb and sometimes it just doesn't apply. One aspect, proverb gives you one aspect of truth for a particular situation. One aspect of truth. It's kind of like in the old days we did vectors. It's like a vector that goes a certain direction. And it gives you, in that direction, yes, it gives you the truth and stuff, but that vector's going this way, it's not going this way. And so you got to be very careful. It's a vector. It's not giving you comprehensive, universal truth. So therefore, Proverbs 22:6, for example, train up a child in the way he shall go. When he's old, he'll not depart from it. Okay? Train up a child in the way he shall go, Proverbs 22:6. When he's old, he'll not depart from it. Is that always true? I know parents that have trained their children very well, and the kids have gone to pot. I've also known some parents who bailed out on their kids, abused their kids, and their kids turned out wonderfully. Okay, so you can't say to train up a child in the way he shall go, and when he's old and not depart from it, is always right. By the way, this even works for God. If you look at Isaiah chapter 1, God was the perfect father, right? And in Isaiah 1, God himself laments. He said, he's the perfect father, right? Our father who art in heaven. The father in heaven has raised his children, Israel, and he says, what have they done? They've rebelled against me. Train up a child in the way he shall go, and when he's old, they'll not depart from it. What, really? Well, Israel, did Israel rebel against God? Yes, they did. And so God's lamenting the fact that he was a perfect father, but his children rebelled against him and went away from him. So Proverbs 22:6, basically what I'm trying to say is a proverb is not a promise. Let's just put that out on the table. Proverb is not a promise. Okay? And so a proverb, you can't say, well, I've got this proverb, train up a child, therefore if I train up a child properly, he'll go in the way. No, that's not always true. And actually your child may end up dying for some reason when they're 18 years old. They never got to see the end of their life. Life is complex. You can't take a complex situation and approximate it by a single vector or a single proverb and things. So proverbs are not absolute truths, okay? And even Mitre in his book, Twisted Wisdom, acknowledges this, as he studied proverbs all over the world, that basically they're not absolute truths. Okay, so you got to be really careful. That's one of the things when you're interpreting proverbs, a bad mistake. A proverb is not a promise. It does have a particular aspect of authority, though. And that's where you got to come back the other way. Everybody thinks they're a genius today. They say, well, the authority of a proverb is not a promise. And they think, you've told us what a proverb is not. You've not told us what it is. Yes, it is not a promise. I think you got to agree with that. But what is a proverb? What is the nature of authority of a proverb? It does have authority. And when it's quoted in cultures all over the world, it has a certain authority to it. And so you've got to come to grips with what is the nature of the authority of a proverb. It's different from a universal statement, a promise from God or something like that. It's different than that. But what is the nature of its authority? And so you've got to explore that kind of thing. If there is intentional interaction between proverbs in pairs, then one should seek the meaning of the editors may have had in mind when they concatenated, when they juxtaposed, when they put two proverbs adjacent to one another into a pair. And we're going to be looking at this pair today, Proverbs chapter 26, verses 4 and 5. Intertextuality is an interesting new study that's been going on in biblical studies actually for quite a while now, but it's the relation of one text to another. And this is an important field of studies, and as we said in Psalms, that it was a relationship between the Psalms, and now we can ask the same thing in a question in Proverbs. What is the relationship between different Proverbs and things like that? Context of use. How is the proverb actually used? Often in African culture, which still proverbs are very much alive in the African culture, they use the proverb to win a legal case. So if you come down, you present all your evidence, you get your witnesses and stuff, but at the end, if you can come up with a proverb, you can really nail the case because the proverb is generally accepted by everybody. And so therefore, they use it to win a case in an argument. It's a way of encapsulating a story. And sometimes proverbs are used for humor. And so Proverbs, let me just give an example here. Proverbs chapter 23, verses 29 to 35. Chapter 23, verses 29 to 35. Check this out. This is, Proverbs, in Proverbs, these are instructional things, and sometimes they're just plain funny, and they're meant to be that. And so in chapter 23, verse 29 and following, it says, "Who has woe? Who has sorrow?" You can see this is kind of like a riddle. Riddles are related to Proverbs, okay? And so, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who would you guess? Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaints? Who has needless bruising? Now this kind of gives it away. Who has bloodshot eyes? Okay. Those who linger over wine, who go to sample bowls of mixed wine. Do not gaze at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake, it poisons like a viper's. Your eyes will see strange sights. Your mind will imagine confusing things. You will be like, remember we said Proverbs a lot of times, similes. You will be like one sleeping on the high seas, lying on the top of the rigging. You see the boat bouncing back and forth. And it's, okay, person's getting drunk. They hit me, you will say, but I am not hurt. They beat me up, but I don't feel it. When will I wake up so I can find another drink? Kind of the, yeah, the problem with alcoholism and the addiction that comes with that. So, okay. So sometimes probably are kind of humorous in that way. Proverbs are applied in different situations. So, for example, we say a stitch in time saves nine. And so if you're a NASCAR guy and your car's coming around and you may have trouble with something, a stitch in time saves nine. You get it fixed so that to make sure that it runs the race. A stitch in time saves nine. Do it now so you don't have the bigger problem later on, okay? A stitch in time saves nine. That's very different than a student may use it in the context of doing homework. A stitch in time saves nine. So you do your homework, daily little stitches, stitch in time saves nine. Because when you hit the exam, you better know your stuff. And if you've done your homework up to that point, then the exam becomes just a reflection of what you already know. And so it's not a big deal. A stitch in time saves nine. However, you don't do your homework, then you get nine stitches to do all at once. Doesn't work too well. Although most of us are into cramming and know the problems with that type of approach. So what a poem means, what a poem or a proverb means, is discovered on how a poem or how a proverb means. What a poem means is determined by how a poem means. So the what and how are connected. There's a literary aspect to it here that's really reflected, and you've got to see how it comes to meaning. And the form and meaning are connected in poetry. It's kind of like verbal and nonverbal communication. Actually, much of communication now we've realized is nonverbal. And so I've been in meetings with people and somebody will be giving their opinion and you watch the person over to the side of them kind of rolling their eyes and then kind of like going like this or whatever. And you can just see that the person by their nonverbal is rejecting the idea that this person is saying. And the nonverbal speaks, and that's what I always tell my children. You've got to hear not only what is said, but what is not said. And oftentimes what is not said is actually more important than what is actually said. And so you got to watch the nonverbal. In poetry, it's very similar. You watch what it says, but how do you determine what it's saying? But you've got to listen to how it's saying it. Poetry will have all sorts of little features and wonderful things that make it beautiful. And you've got to pick up those things if you're going to understand what the poet, what the proverbial wise person was meaning. So we do not miss the author's poetic craft and intent. We should also not miss the editor's craft and intent as he builds or she builds the book together and shapes the book out of the single proverbs. As a poet puts words together to make a poem, so the editor takes proverbial sentences and builds those together into the meaning of the book. So editorial meaning and authorial meaning, very important. The journey to discover meanings in Proverbs. We've got a historical setting that we need to take seriously. And so, for example, Solomon, Hezekiah, Augur, Lemuel, the sayings of the wise. So we look at the historical kind of context in which these Proverbs and through which the Proverbs were collected and authored and things. There's literary expression. You've got aesthetics going on. Sometimes, like we said in Proverbs 31, there's an acrostic where the virtuous woman, you've got 22 verses exactly, and each one begins with the next letter of the alphabet. It's an acrostic. It's trying to say, I've gone A to Z. This is the climactic expression of this virtuous woman, or, quote, Madam Wisdom, as I would take it, and things, although there's a lot of disagreement on how you interpret Proverbs 31. Acrostic. A chiastic structure, where you've got, sometimes the poets will use an A, B, C, and then a CBA type what's called a chiastic structure. It's called chi because in chi in Greek is like an X. And so you'd have A, B, B, A. And so if you connect the two Bs, you connect the two As, it makes like an X, it makes a chi. So they call it a chiastic structure. So sometimes you get what's called an inclusio. An inclusio means the beginning and the end are connected. And so oftentimes in a story, and how many times does this happen, the story begins, you know, one way, and it ends coming back around to the beginning, and those are called an inclusio. They're called like bookends. A story begins the way it ends, and sometimes you get that kind of structure as well, inclusios. So there are many of these kind of structures. Sometimes you get a hinge, or what they call a janus, okay? And a janus was a thing with the I think it was Latins, but what you had this two-headed coin where one head goes this way and the other head goes this way. And so you got two heads facing like this. And a janus means that basically it's a connecting verse where you come down a certain section and then you've got a connecting verse. It refers back up to what came before it, but it also refers down to what comes after it. And that's called a janus or a hinge, kind of like a hinge on a door connected the things. And so anyways, there's different things. Phonology also, a lot of times you get a phonology on a onomatopoeia kind of things. And so, for example, I just out of my head, there's this mikasesina sifte sheker. Mikasesina sifte. You can hear this. Mikasesina sifte sheker. The verse is about the gossip. Psst, 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 psst. We even do in modern English. Mikasesina sifte. It's about a gossip. And so sometimes the phonology of how something sounds is playing off the sound of the gossip as well as the communication, by the way. And it really helps to know Hebrew then because you can pick up these sounding things which don't come over in translation. There's almost no way to translate that. You get the rhetorical aspects that you got to take in. What's the relationship of the speaker and the addressee and the audience? The speaker and the audience. What's the relationship between the speaker and the audience? Rhetorically, and poetics, parallelism, as we mentioned earlier, parallelism is absolutely critical. A wise son brings joy to a father, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. You can see that they're parallel. The father and mother are parallel. One brings joy, one brings grief. A wise son brings joy, a foolish son brings grief. And so you can see how those two lines are parallel. And so there's a whole study in parallelism. Actually, we should do a whole presentation just on the nature of parallelism in Hebrew poetry. It's wonderful. Sound and sense, as we said, combining terseness in Proverbs, very terse. And so those will be used as poetic features to capture the proverbial moment. Figurative language, metaphor, simile, metonymy, really important things. These are figures of speech, hyperbole are overstatements for emphasis. Parody, sometimes there is a parody. It's got a humorous side to it about the drunk, you know, he's going back and forth. It's kind of a parody on that. Generalization also. These figures of speech, especially metaphor and metonymy, there's a new type of study called cognitive linguistics. And there's huge studies been done now on metaphor and understanding metaphor and metonymy and the relationship between a metonymy, which would be a combination of metaphor and metonymy put together. And what they're realizing in cognitive linguistics is that we think. These are not just, I call them figures of speech, but I don't like that terminology anymore, figures of speech. When you say that a metaphor or a metonymy is a figure of speech, it's kind of like it's a frill thing that, you know, the poetic guy is getting artistic and person is getting artistic and things. No, that's not what the cognitive linguistics are saying. No, we think. Our brains are wired to think metaphorically. That is, this rain, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Okay? Though your sins be as scarlet, they'll be as white as snow. Well, what? And then, so there's a relationship between two different categories, okay? Two different categories, sins, white, snow, and things. So, metaphor and metonymy, actually how we think, and metonymy, another aspect of how our brains put together meaning, saying parts for whole, like a synecdoche is a type of metonymy, etc. We won't want to get into all that stuff. It can go on forever, but just be aware that those things are happening. And the literary form, what is a proverb? Forms are used. The proverbial sage uses forms. So, for example, in Proverbs chapter 30, there are definite forms that the proverb the sage uses. And let's see. Okay, I guess I'll just read it from the scripture here itself rather than the printed. But Proverbs 30, it's interesting that the and you can begin to pick it up. Here it is, Proverbs chapter 30, the sayings of Agur. Now let's just see what types of things he uses. He uses what are called numerical proverbs. Numerical proverbs. And just check this out. Okay. Three things are never satisfied. Four that never say enough. The grave, the barren womb, land, which is never satisfied with water, and fire, which never says enough. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 18, another numerical proverb. See, this is a form that he's using. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand. Three and four. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas. Israelites were land lovers, okay, up in the mountains. A way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a woman. I'm not going to comment on that, but you can see numerical proverbs, okay, beautiful, and they had these certain structures that were used then in constructing proverbs, constructing proverbial literature and stuff. You had cultural settings. Cultural settings would be like, and many have done massive studies on this, you have the royal court involved, and you'll see many of the proverbs, Proverbs chapter 16, for example, a ton of king proverbs, okay? And so it had to do, the proverbs were often constructed and used in the court, the king's court. Other times you get proverbs that are very much folk-oriented, and they tell you about the common folk. A lot of times they're involved in pedagogical functions, teaching children, and just teaching basic principles of morality or what other things the proverbs are doing. There's also a judicial aspect of them too, where they argue for social justice types of things and judicial. Social factors, kings, scribes, teachers, students, those also help us to put this in a context. Kings, scribes, teachers, students, family, father and mother and children, really important. Education was done in the context of the family, and these proverbs reflect that. A wise son brings joy to a father, foolish son is a grief to his mother. Listen, my son, to your father's instruction. Hear your mother's teaching. And so the parents were very much involved in their education. Sounds like something we should consider. Canonical function. How are proverbs used in narratives? And so we have then, as Carol Fontaine did a beautiful book called The Traditional Sayings in the Old Testament, in which he traced proverbs, not in the book of Proverbs, but outside in the historical narrative, these proverbs came up. So is Saul among the prophets? That was 1 Samuel 10. And so you have these proverbs. Also another canonical function is Proverbs 26, 4 and 5 that we're going to look at today. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. And the next verse says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. These two verses seem to contradict one another. And so Proverbs, when it went to get in the Bible, was called the antilegomena, that which is spoken against. There were five books in the Old Testament canon that were anti-legomena. In terms of when they went to put the Old Testament canon together, there were these books that had problems with them. And so you had books like Proverbs where there's this clash, answer not a fool according to his folly, and then the next verse says answer a fool according to his folly. Seems to contradict in things. The book of Ezekiel, which describes a temple as being like 1,200 miles this way and 1,200 miles that way, is too big for what it is in Israel and stuff. And so Ezekiel would be one of those ones that was questioned also. And there were five of these anti-legomena books. But Proverbs was one of those anti-legomena books because of this, because of the verses we're going to look at today, chapters 6 and 25. Now, I want to call these guys willy-nilly advocates. There are certain people, and I'm going to read here from an article I wrote in the Journal of Biblical Literature, and just read some of the statements. Are the Proverbs in chapters 10 to 29 thrown together haphazardly, or are they ordered? I'm trying to argue that they were ordered by an editor, and that gives us another level of meaning that we need to look at, what the editor was doing putting these back-to-back and things. And so, Oresteely writes this, But generally speaking, the Proverbs are thrown together in a very haphazard fashion in this collection. Yeah, I tend to disagree, but many still agree with that. R. Gordon explains Proverbs are difficult to read because, quote, there is little continuity or progression, end quote. A to B to C to D, plot, direction, beginning story, middle story, climax, end of story. It's not like that in Proverbs. And so he says, whoa. Gerhard von Rod expresses his annoyance at the, quote, lack of order of the Proverbs. And so, and McCain, who wrote a major commentary on it, sees these Proverbs as atomistic and things. Bernard Lang makes this comment. The book of Proverbs is almost random collection of brief didactic discourses, poems, learned and pious sayings. Ryalar Stam says this, even when two or more successive proverbs deal more or less with the same subject, for example, chapter 10, verses 4 and 5, notice that's a pair, but is he going to play that up or play it down? The connection seems to be incidental rather than organic. There is no logical continuity of thought. So that's what a lot of people are saying about Proverbs, that these things are scattered and they're haphazard and they're willy-nilly and therefore atomistic, self-contained Proverbs, disconnected, helter-skelter, disarranged, disordered. What is a proverb pair? Now I'm going to give a definition of a proverb pair. Two proverbial sentences that are bonded together, whether by means of phonetics, semantics, catchwords, syntax, rhetorical device, situation, or theme into a higher architectonic unit. There's two proverbs that are adjacent, that are concatenated, they're put back to back. Two proverbs that are together, that are bonded together by phonetics, semantics, catchwords, syntax, rhetorical devices, situation, or theme into a higher unit. So there's some meaning to be had there on what was the intent of the editor by putting those two together. Now, each one means something by itself, and I don't want to downplay that at all. Each proverb by itself has a significant meaning on its own. But when you put them back to back, they kind of dance together. And a dancing together is very different than a person doing the moves by themselves. Okay? And so that's what I'm trying to say. Stuart Weeks discovered such adjacent sayings in 1994. Problem was, apparently he ignored my article. It was written 6 years earlier than that, but it's 6 years late, but at least he got it, that there are proverb pairs. And literary craftsmanship can be seen. These are the Proverbs of Solomon that were collected by Hezekiah's men, Proverbs chapter 25, 1. These are the Proverbs of Solomon that were collected, and then they're collected by these editors who then select certain Proverbs and don't select other Proverbs. First Kings 4 and 5 tell us that Solomon wrote like 3,000 Proverbs. We only have about 375. We got about one-tenth or less of what Solomon actually put together from the First Kings 4 and 5 passages. So they were edited later on by Hezekiah's men, which is, I don't know, a couple half centuries after the time of Solomon. There are examples of longer units, as we said, Proverbs 31, acrostic of the virtuous woman, the numerical sayings, which are several proverbs in a row, and that type of thing. Now, how frequent are proverb pairs? How frequent are proverb pairs? In Proverbs chapter 10, verses 10 to 29, I'm sorry, Proverbs chapter 10 to 29, there are about 595 verses. Okay, Proverbs 10, chapter 10 to 29, there are 595 verses. I found in going through those 62 examples of pairing, 62 examples, which is 124 verses. So you've got 595 verses, 124 of those are paired up. That's 21%. 21% of the Proverbs that are supposed to be helter-skeltered, scattered together, Proverbs chapter 10, sentences to 29, but yet there's an example of 124 of those, or 21%, are found in pairs. For example, Proverbs chapter 15, verses 16 and 17, it says, are two better than Proverbs, okay? Are two better than Proverbs. And so these are put back to back. And let's see if I've got that. Yeah, I've got that written here. It says, better a little with the fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. That's one proverb. And then the next proverb right after it says, better a small serving of vegetables with love than a fattened calf with hatred. And so these are put back to back, these two. And yet there's 21 of these better than proverbs. In the whole book of Proverbs, there's 21 of these, what they call better than proverbs, better this than that kind of thing, the structure. And so there's 21 of those. But notice here, out of the 21, two of them occur back to back. What is the possibility of that? What is the probability of that? If you have 21 and you got 31 chapters and you got 21 examples, you'd think they'd be scattered all over the place, and sometimes they are. But in this case, you got two put back to back. Not only two in the same chapter, but they're put back to back. And this shows that they're being paired up. They're being paired up. One proverb contextualizing another. For example, the wealth of the rich is their fortified city. This is Proverbs chapter 10, verses 15 and 16. Proverbs chapter 10, verses 15 and 16 says, the wealth of the rich is their fortified city, but poverty is the ruin of the poor. If you've ever been poor, you know what the ruin of the poor means and stuff. So this is not describing how it should be. It's describing how it is in life. So then what happens is, then, this proverb is saying, you know, the rich is their fortified city and the poverty is the ruin of the poor. The next verse kind of qualifies it a little bit. The wages of the righteous is life, but the earnings of the wicked is sin and death. And so it's saying, if you've got your wealth but you're wicked, you got a big problem. And if you're poor and you're righteous, you get life and things. And so the one verse kind of contextualizes and helps us with the meaning of the other. Now, there's a chiastic structure here that's been noticed by a guy named Steinman, who's written an excellent commentary on the book of Proverbs. It's also been noted by a guy named Ray Van Leeuwen, who has written extensively on Proverbs chapters 25 to 27, but he's also written a whole commentary in the Interpreter's Bible on this. And they've noticed, then, this chiastic structure. Now, remember we said chiastic was, that's the X, key in Greek, A, B, B, A. Now, this is an extended one, but he takes verses... Proverbs chapter 26, verses 1 to 12, as a chiastic structure. And I want to read through chapter 26, verses 1 to 12, and show you that basically this whole 1 to 12 is what Toy, who's an older commentator, wrote on Proverbs, calls this the Book of Fools. So in the Book of Proverbs, you got all these sentence sayings, chapters 10 to 29, but in chapter 26, verses 1 to 12, these verses all seem to hang together around the topic of the fool. So Toy calls this chapter 26, verses 1 to 12, the Book of Fools. And I would probably call it the Scroll of Fools, but anyways, he said the Book of Fools. Let me just read this then. Proverbs chapter 26, verses 1 and following. Like snow in the summer or rain in the harvest, honor is not fitting for a fool. Now that's going to be a key phrase. Honor is not fitting for a fool. Proverbs chapter 26 verses 1 to 12. The idea is, what is fitting? What is fitting? And it says here, like snow in summer or rain in harvest, honor is not fitting for a fool. Like a fluttering sparrow and a darting swallow, an undeserved curse does not come to rest. A whip for a horse and a bridle for a donkey, and a rod for the back of fools. There again, the fool comes to head. A whip for the horse and a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the back of fools. Then our two verses we're going to be looking at, Proverbs chapter 26, 4 and 5. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be just like him. Verse 5, answer a fool according to his folly, or he'll be wise in his own eyes. See the kind of conundrum or paradox, or some people call contradiction, in these two verses, and we'll look at that. Sending a message by the hand of a fool is like cutting off one's feet or drinking poison. Don't send messages by a fool. Like a useless legs of one who is lame is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. Proverbs are for wisdom, right? But can a fool cite proverbs? Yeah. And it's like useless legs, one who is lame, is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. Like tying a stone in a sling is giving honor to a fool. Fools should not have honor. Like a thorn bush in a drunkard's hand is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. When a fool quotes a proverb, it's like having a thorn stuck in your hand. Like an archer who wounds at random is one who hires a fool or any passerby. As a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool repeats its folly, their folly. And then the last verse, do you see a person wise in their own eyes? There is more hope for a fool than for them. Read that last verse. Do you see a person wise in their own eyes? There is more hope for them than a fool. What's worse than being a fool? Being wise in your own eyes. Pride, arrogance is worse than being a fool, according to the last verse, summation of this Proverbs section here. Now, A, honoring a fool is not fitting. B, inconsequential curse. C, a double comparison, disciplining a fool. Not answering a fool. D, answer a fool. D prime. C, a double comparison of the folly using a fool for important business. And B, an inconsequential proverb. And then A, honoring is not fitting for a fool. Honor is not fitting for a fool, verse 1. Honor is not fitting for a fool, verse 8. So you can see how it kind of goes in, A, B, C, D, and then D, C, B, A, back out. It's a chiasm. And so this is, by the way, I'll have this, I'll cut these in. The PowerPoints are going to be available online. You can download the PowerPoint, and actually probably should download the PowerPoint, and you can follow along through this lengthy lecture on this stuff. But so I've got the chiasm laid out there. Now, what Steinman notices is there's kind of a chiasm and tucked in another chiasm, and this is what he calls E1, a fool's stupidity, chapter 26, verse 4. E2, the fool's stupidity is his wisdom, 26:5. F is the folly of using a fool for important business, verse 6. G, a proverb in the mouth of fools, 26:7. H, the focus of the chiasm, H, honor is not fitting for a fool. And so that's the major message of this whole section. Honor is not fitting for a fool. So what is fitting for a fool? It's asking, how do you deal with a fool? Okay, honor is not fitting for a fool. Chapter 26, verse 8. Notice that 26:1 basically said the same thing. Okay, a proverb in the mouth of fools, 26:9, G, and then coming back out, F, folly of using a fool for important business, 26:10 is F, and then E1, a fool's stupidity, verse 11, and then a fool's wisdom. Better to be a fool than to be wise in your own eyes, chapter 26, verse 12, and ends like that. So Steinman, I think, points out these two embedded chiasms, really interesting structure. All I'm trying to say is that when the editors put this thing together, they have to throw this stuff together. This is very well, chapters 26, verses 1 to 12, is extremely well constructed, and there is a higher meaning. And I think Van Leeuwen's correct, and he's saying that it's basically telling us how we need to interpret Proverbs. And so this is the interpretation or the hermeneutic of wisdom, that everything's not cut and dry, everything's not straightforward. You see situations, they're complex, and you need to interpret them various light. You got a fool who can quote a proverb. Okay? So you've got to do some thinking about this stuff. And fool and worse. Hermeneutics evaluating what is fitting. Honor given to a fool. That's repeated, by the way, in verses 1 and verse 8. A rod for the back of fools, okay? Again, what is fitting for a fool? A rod for the back of fools. Answering a fool or not? There's a repetition, a major repetition. Answer not a fool according to his folly. Next verse, answer a fool according to his folly. So there's a high repetition in verses 4 and 5 that we're going to be looking at. Sending a fool as an envoy. Again, is it what is fitting? Don't send a fool when you want an envoy or an ambassador. Fool spouting a proverb, chapter 26:7, 26:9, both have a fool spouting a proverb. Hiring workers, a drunk, don't do a drunk and don't do a fool, hire it, verse 10. And so basically Van Leeuwen lays these out as things that are not appropriate for a fool, and he's just telling you how to deal with a fool there. So, okay, comparing variations. Now, this can be fun. Notice how I'm trying to maintain, and I tried to show you 21% of this Proverbs 10 to 29 are these pairs. 21% of them are like that. There's like 60-some of them, okay? But there's also variations. There's triads. Sometimes there's three Proverbs in a row. We call those triads. Stuart Weeks in his book Early Israelite Wisdom also notes these triads. For example, chapter 23, verses 26 to 28, and chapter 24, verses 10 through 12, etc. Sometimes I discovered what are called split pairs. In other words, there's two verses that are kind of close to one another, but they're paired to one another. And so I call them split pairs, okay? An example, Proverbs chapter 10, verse 8 and verse 10. There's a verse that goes in between them, but those two, 8 and 10, go together. Same thing with chapter 16, verse 32 and chapter 17, verse 1. Those two go together, but there's a verse in between. Same thing with chapter 17, verse 26 and chapter 17, verse 1. Now, the pair plus one detached. Sometimes I found that there was a pair, but then there was a verse intervening and then another one detached. So this is kind of like a broken triad. You got a pair that's tight, there's a verse slotted in there, and then there's another one. So it's like a triad, or it's like a pair plus one. And you have that in 15, 1 and 2, and then verse 4. You've got that in 15, verses 8 and 9, and verse 11. And you've got that in chapter 20, verses 16 and 17, and then verse 20. So this idea of a pair plus one attached. And then something that's really been controversial, and I just am so grateful for the fellow who is a wonderful brother, Knut Heim, one of the leading people in the study of Proverbs in the world, did a series for us in the book of Proverbs, and it's up on YouTube. You can watch it and stuff like that. He's got a thing that he calls clusters. And so not only do you have pairs and triads, but then you have clusters of these proverbial things where they're linked together. I called them strings earlier, but he calls them clusters, and I give way to him. He's obviously a major expert on this stuff. Chapter 11, verses 9 to 12, for example. Chapter 15, verses 29 to 33, how these things are connected up in these clusters. And so there's just not pairs, triads, pairs plus one, but there's also these strings or these clusters of Proverbs that go together that the editors had placed together. Now, I'm going to go through five examples of pairs, but we're only going to do one today because this one on 26, 4, and 5 is a major because of the conundrum or paradox or conflict or contradiction, however you want to determine to say it. And it's verses 4 and 5. Proverbs chapter 26, verses 4 and 5 reads, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him yourself." Next verse, "Answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes." Should you not answer a fool, as the first verse says, or should you answer a fool, as the next verse says? So these are called contradictory proverbs. And what I want to do before we jump actually into the biblical text here is actually have some fun and just play around. This phenomena of two proverbs kind of clashing with one another is found all over the world in all different periods. And so contradictory proverbs are a well-known phenomena. Alster, who's dealing with two beautiful volumes on Proverbs of Ancient Sumeria. Okay, we're talking Sumeria, way back, thousands of years before Solomon. Okay, 1,000 years before Solomon, or many hundred years before Solomon, before Israel. The Sumer, history begins at Sumer kind of thing. And he notices, he's put together this collection of Sumerian proverbs, and he notices that some of them are conflicting, contradictory and things. Part of the genre in almost all languages then uses this contrast. Mitre, the guy from Vermont who studies these things, also calls them anti or twisted proverbs. And what we'll do is we'll examine some twisted proverbs in English. We'll just have some fun with that, okay? I know this is long, but I wanted to do it in detail because I know if I don't do it in detail, who's going to do it? So anyways, English proverbs, and we'll just have some fun with his book. He wrote a book called Twisted Wisdom, Modern Anti-Proverbs in 1999, and we'll look at some of those anti-proverbs. You guys will know them. The Sumerian proverbs, we'll grab a couple from Ulster, and then we'll go over to Nigeria, and there's a Yoruba Proverbs that are come from Nigeria, and we'll look at some of the contrast between those. And then also, actually, even in Scripture, you get tensions between things that they kind of clash and stuff. You got the sovereignty of God on the one hand, the free will of man on the other. How do those things fit together? Well, if you're Reformed, they go one way. If you're more Arminian perspective, they go the other way. And, you know, which one you're going to emphasize and stuff. You're like me, and you stand in the middle, get hit by both sides. Faith and works. Is it by faith or is it by works? And faith without works is dead, but yet faith, you know, works then is no good and stuff. And so you get this. The Trinity, the whole notion of the Trinity is God, you know, is one. Shema Yisrael, and I, you know, and I had, okay, hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God. Yahweh is one. And yet we've got Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so therefore three in one. And how does the Trinity, you say, well, that's just a Trinity and dismiss it. No, no, man. Trinity is a mystery, is incredible when you start thinking about it more deeply, as the church fathers did. So there are these kind of clashing things. So let's just play with English, okay? English, paradoxical or contradictory proverbs. It's part of a genre, and Mitre presents some of these. Now let me just take one. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. In other words, I'm down at seminary, my wife's back at Buffalo State College and stuff, and absence makes the heart grow fonder. And I, you know, desire to be with her and stuff. And so as the absence, then my desire and just longing for my wife to be grew much strongly. So absence makes the heart grow fonder. We know what that's like. How about this one? Absence makes the heart grow fonder for someone else. Whoa. And you know what that's like, okay? So guy falls in love with this girl or whatever. And she's over here, he's over here, and then all of a sudden he meets this other character, woman here, and he falls in love with her now, and now he's got a real problem. I think that happened actually in the series called Yellowstone, and the guy, his own girlfriend and stuff. I'm not putting an advertisement for that, but anyways. So absence makes the heart go fonder for someone else, and you can see how the proverb is twisted there. Absence makes, here's another one, and I've said this one myself, absence makes the heart to grow fonder. Absence makes the heart to wander. Whoa. A variational technique substituting a rhyming word. Fonder, wander. Two totally different meanings built off the same proverb and stuff. Here's another. Now, this is a real anti-proverb. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Out of sight, out of mind. Out of sight, out of mind. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, or is it out of sight, out of mind? Two totally clashing, contradictory proverbs. And so we have fun with those in English, and they're kind of fun to play with these things. Here's one. This is an interesting one. X a day keeps the Y away. Okay. Now, this is the way we all know. An apple a day keeps the doctor away. Okay, that's the proverb. An apple a day keeps the doctor away. Most of us have heard that when we were children. An apple a day keeps the doctor away. Apples are good to eat. Apple a day keeps the doctor away. Okay, that's the proverb. How about this one? Twisted proverb. A crisis a day keeps impeachment away. Bill Clinton. Okay, a crisis a day keeps the impeachment away. Okay, and that was used in political circles and stuff. This, here's another one, twist to it. A laugh a day keeps the psychiatrist away. A laugh a day keeps the psychiatrist a day. Good to be happy and laugh at times. Here's another one. An effort a day keeps failure away. An effort a day keeps the failure away. Put in effort, discipline. Discipline equals freedom. I think there's a guy named Jocko said that. Discipline equals freedom. Effort a day keeps failure away. And now here's one. Proverbs are meant, everybody gets into this thing where, oh, it's in the Bible, it's got to be truth and truth and all these heavy, big things. Sometimes Proverbs are meant to have fun, okay? The guy is, you know, in a mask, he's going back and forth, hit me, but I don't feel it. And it's a parody, okay? And so you got to kind of lighten up a little bit with these Proverbs and stuff. So here's one like the light. An onion a day keeps everybody away. An onion a day keeps everyone away. And you say, it's meant to put a smile on your face. And, you know, okay, here's another one that's more religious. A chapter of the Bible a day keeps Satan away. A chapter a day keeps Satan away. Some good advice there. And then An apple a day keeps the doctor away, and so does not paying your bills. You don't pay your bills, you don't see the doctor. Okay? Apples are so expensive these days, you may as well have a doctor. Better than an apple a day. Better than an apple a day. Okay? And then this one's a chicken, a discussion between two chickens. So the old hen says to the young hen, the old hen says, let me give you a good piece of advice. Notice we're in a kind of an advice, old hen, young hen, old wisdom, young person learning. Okay, so we're in that kind of context, only they use chickens and stuff. Okay, let me give you a piece of good advice. The young hen says, what is it? The old hen says, an egg a day keeps the axe away. An egg a day keeps the axe away. In other words, you better take care to do your eggs. Okay, these are twisted proverbs. Wolfgang Meter, thanks to him. Kind of some fun thing. I had fun with these with my daughter, actually. I think it took place, actually, in this very room. Our family, we've got a major conflict. I'm a major morning person. Like, I get up usually 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm retired now, and I still get up at 5 in the morning, 5:30. Sometimes I sleep into 5:30 like I did this morning. But anyways, my wife is a major night person, so she goes to bed between 2 and 4 a.m. in the morning. Okay, so we kind of miss that way. Well, our children then are all, actually, they all take after her pretty much, okay? So night people kind of thing. And so I was trying to tell my daughter, she needs to get up early and get, the best part of my day is between like 6 in the morning and noon. I get a whole day's work done just then. So I'm trying to encourage my daughter. She's going to Gordon College and trying to get her to really hit the ground running and stuff. So I tell her, the early bird gets the worm. The early bird gets the worm. I really believe that. So get up early, get your stuff going, and get on the road, okay? She is a really smart whip. My kids are all smarter than I am. But anyways, my daughter came back without blinking an eye. She says, yeah, Dad, the early bird gets the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese. The second mouse gets the cheese. And so we had a kind of a proverb war. And it was fun. It was playful banter between a father and his daughter. And anyways, look before you leap. Here's another proverb. Look before you leap. So look before you leap. And there needs to be a little hesitation here because you're going to leap and you're jumping off something. Look before you leap to what you're getting down into, okay? You used to jump off cliffs into water quarries and things like that. And you look to make sure there's enough water down there to catch you when you jump off an 80-foot cliff and things like that. Look before you leap. But the other proverb says, he who hesitates is lost. You take too much time looking and stuff like that, you hesitate, it's lost. You've lost the opportunity. If at first you don't succeed, try again. If you don't succeed, try again. The other proverb says, don't beat your head against the wall. In other words, you got to know when to quit, man. If at first you don't succeed, try again. Next proverb says, don't beat your head against the wall. Okay, or don't beat a dead horse, okay? You got to know when to pull back. I mean, when things are going wrong, you got to say, I got a problem here, and you got to reanalyze. And so if you don't do that, you're just going to keep banging your head against the wall. And we've got many people today that just keep doing the same thing and making the same mistakes over and over, okay? You're never too old to learn. You're never too old to learn. I love this one. You're never too old to learn. What's the other proverb? You can't teach an old dog new tricks. You're never too old to learn, or is it you can't teach an old dog new tricks? Okay? Do you give up on the old folks, or do you, give them a break? Many hands make light work. Many hands make light work. I love that. Many hands make light work. Whoa. What's the other proverb say? Too many cooks in the kitchen spoil the broth. Too many cooks in the kitchen spoil the broth. Whoops. Too many? Okay, so you get it. Save for a rainy day. Save for a rainy day. It's kind of a proverb. Save up for a rainy day. Another proverb coming the other way. Tomorrow will take care of itself. Almost sounds biblical. Matthew chapter 6, was that? Anyways, tomorrow will take care of itself. So, now, let's jump into Sumer. Here's some Sumerian proverbs. One cannot take anything out of the mouth of the poor. Sumerian proverbs. About 1800, 1900 BC. that's like back in the time with Abraham, okay? It's like a thousand years almost before David and Solomon. Okay, so one cannot take anything out of the mouth of the poor. There's nothing in there, okay? Next proverb says, so lowly is a poor man that what is taken from his mouth is thus restored. And so it comes back the other way and says, well, wait a minute, you know, and I'm not sure I understand these two proverbs, but they're obviously contradictory things being said there. Here's an Yoruba proverb from Nigeria, okay? And they use proverbs here to bolster their arguments in legal contexts and other things. It says, an empty barrel makes the loudest noise. An empty barrel makes the loudest noise. The one that has content does not make noise. In other words, if you fill a barrel up with sand and you wrap it, it doesn't make much noise at all. But you take that same barrel, you pour out all the sand, and it's an empty barrel, you hit it, it goes gong, and it makes a big sound. So an empty barrel makes the loudest noise. An empty barrel makes the loudest noise. But one that has content doesn't, okay? So what's it saying? As you see what it's saying in terms of a person? That a lot of times the people with the loudest mouth have nothing in their heads. But anyways, okay, sorry. The contrast to that is, if you do not praise yourself, nobody will praise you. So in other words, yeah, it's an empty thing, but if you don't praise yourself, nobody will. And so those two proverbs kind of hit at each other in various ways. Here's another one on a warrior. A warrior does not receive a wound on the back. A warrior does not receive a wound on the back. A warrior is always out fighting, and so he takes his wounds on his front and stuff. He does not receive on the back. Next proverb comes in. To fight and run is the beauty of bravery. To fight and run is the beauty of bravery. In other words, you got to be smart enough to know you're losing the battle. Get out of there. Okay? And so the other one says he doesn't take a wound in the back, but you got to know when to bail out and stuff. And so these are two kind of contrary proverbs and stuff from Yoruba. And things. So these are, there's a book that I've been using for some of this stuff by Peter Hatton. It's called Contradiction in the Book of Proverbs, The Deep Waters of Counsel. It's 2008. Very excellent book. These contradictions are not imperfections, but part of a subtle and profound didactic strategy to awaken critical faculties in the readers. They're kind of like eddies. You know what eddy is? The water comes down, but then waters come down, but then there's an eddy that kind of circles back around like that. So actually, even though the water's going this way in the eddy, the water goes up against it and things. So which way is the water flowing? The water's flowing this way, but the eddy takes it back the other way. And so what Hatton is pointing out here is that critical faculties, they take account of the major flow of the water, yes, but they also see the eddies that they ripple up back the other way. Hatton writes this, we shall discover that Proverbs achieves its goal of awakening its readers to wisdom by introducing contradictions into the flow of its sayings. This defamiliarizes not only just the sayings concerned, but also the context and other sayings around them. The reader, audience, is goaded into paying renewed attention to a form of wisdom whose familiarity might lead to it being dismissed. In other words, these proverbs, a stitch in time saves nine, you don't even think about it anymore. But what happens is when they get these clashes, then all of a sudden you start thinking about the nuances. What is the real meaning of this? It's a pondering hermeneutic. When you clash the two like this, it creates a pondering hermeneutic or a pondering interpretation that you go back at, evaluating what is fitting in our Proverbs chapter 26. Timing is important. People, the character of the people is important. The situation, sociological and rhetorical, those are all important and have to be taken into account. So, internal contrary items in a single proverb. So here, Hatton's pointing out some conflicts within a certain proverb, within a proverb itself. Proverbs 13:24 says this, withholds his rod, he who withholds his rod hates his son. Now you say, wait a minute, a father who withholds the rod, okay, we don't do the rod thing anymore, okay. I wonder whether we should, but anyways. He who withholds his rod hates his son. Who loves him, disciplines him early. So it's kind of the reverse. You know, the guy that supposedly seems to be merciful is actually hates his son, and the one who loves him is careful to discipline his son. Now, this is contrary to a lot of parenting I see going on today, where the parent does not discipline the child and says, hey, I want to be the fun person, and doesn't do any discipline. And well, this says the one who withholds the rod actually hates his child, but the one who disciplines the child early, that's the one who really loves him. And so this is a really important proverb, kind of goes the other way. Here's another one, chapter 26, and 27, verse 6, Proverbs 27, 6. Trustworthy are a lover's blows. So in other words, a lover's blows, wham, are trustworthy, but dangerous the caresses of one who hates. In other words, you get a person who hates a person, they use caresses and all sorts of getting close, touchy-feely kind of thing. That's no, be careful. Trustworthy are the lover's blows. In other words, if you get a friend who tells you the way it is and has enough guts, and I think a lot of people need these kind of people, a person is able to kind of like, and that's one of the things I really respect about my wife, is she'll tell me when I mess up. She'll tell me. Now, of course, she's always wrong, but she'll tell me when I'm, you know, doing something goofy or something that's wrong, incorrect. And then I got to weigh that, and I got to correct usually, because she's usually right. Okay, don't tell her that. But anyways, so you've got to, the one trustworthy are a lover's blows, okay, and the dangerous are the caresses of one who hates. Here's another one, Proverbs 31, verses 4 through 7. Lemuel's mother is talking to him. Lemuel's the king, and his mother is talking to him, and she basically says this. Okay, I'll just paraphrase it. She says, when you're the king, don't get drunk. Because if you're the king and you get drunk, you can do major damage. Because you can destroy justice in your drunken stupor. You can destroy justice. And you're the king. Don't get drunk. Maintain your justice and things like that. However, she then comes back the other way and she says, but wine and strong drink are for the poor. And those who are needy and those who have a really rough time in life. And she says, those are the people that should be drinking, okay, as an escape and things like that. And so just a really interesting thing there in terms of Proverbs and things. Proverbs 25:15, with patience a ruler is persuaded. A soft tongue can break a bone. Okay, do you see the clash there? A soft tongue can break a bone. In other words, a person is gentle when he speaks to the king, can actually persuade the king. And we've kind of lost the art of persuasion today. Okay, we'd rather just, stereotype people and put them in this box or this box, and they're all wrong, and these guys are all right, and stuff like that. I'm with this group, these guys are our enemies, and this kind of stuff. He said, no, a soft tongue can break a bone. And so this is a beautiful proverb, but again, you see the clash, the soft tongue breaking a hard bone. And that... you can ask it as a riddle. What is soft yet breaks a bone? So you can take the proverb and turn it into a riddle. What is soft that breaks a bone? The tongue. So that kind of thing is available as well. Ahikar, writing in the 400s BC in the Assyrian court of Sennacherib, basically in other proverbs and stuff, by controlling temper, one galls a commander. A soft tongue breaks a bone. So here we have in another culture, an Assyrian culture, not Israel. Israel's got it in Proverbs 25:15, a soft tongue can break a bone. Here you are in the 400s, and Ahikar has basically a soft tongue can break a bone, which is interesting. Proverbs are international. Proverbs were international. Proverbs of Solomon, where he was wiser than the men of Egypt. Apparently they knew the people of Egypt were wise, and so they compare. There's a comparison contrast between cultures and the nature of their proverbs and stuff. Now, the nature of repetition in Proverbs. There's a wonderful book out by a guy named Daniel Snell. This book by Daniel Snell is called Twice Told Proverbs and the Composition of the Book of Proverbs. Wonderful book, brilliant guy, discovered this stuff way back and really had some things to say in terms of these twice-told proverbs or the use of repetition. Now, what's interesting is there are three repetitions in our Proverbs chapter 26, 1 to 12. There are three repetitions. And so in chapter 26, verse 1, you've got this, like snow in summer and rain during the harvest, so honor does not befit a fool. Then jump down to verse 8. Verse 8, it says, like tying a stone in a slingshot, so is giving honor to a fool. so is giving honor to a fool. Those two phrases are repeated in chapter 26, verse 1 and 26, verse 8. Here's another one. Legs dangle from a cripple and a proverb from the mouth of fools. That's 26:7, 26:9. Notice they're separated by one verse in the middle. A thorn goes up into the hand of a drunkard and a proverb in the mouth of fools. A proverb in the mouth of fools. Again, a repetition, 26:7, 26:9, this repetition. And then, of course, our verse, answer not a fool according to his folly. The next verse, answer a fool according to his folly. Again, repetition, repetition. In 26, 4, and 5. So those are three repetitions, interesting, all packed in. So repetition becomes an important feature, and usually it's repetition with little twists. And so you got to be careful to pay attention to those little twists. Now, let's talk about cohesion. How is Proverbs 26, 4 related to verse 5? Once the first verse says, do not answer a fool according to his folly. What's verse 6 say? Answer a fool according to his folly. So it's almost exact repetitions except for the word not. Not answer a fool according to his folly. Answer a fool according to his folly. The next verse says, lest you be like him yourself. In other words, what's the consequences of not answering a fool? Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. That's the consequence. Verse 5 says, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. So you can see the repetition here of the answer, do not answer, answer, fool, fool, according to his folly, according to his folly, lest, and then the consequence, and then lest he be wise in his own eyes, consequence and stuff. So you've got an act, answer or not answer, and consequence. And the consequence in the first one is for you. Lest you be like him yourself, and the consequence in the second one is like that he would be wise in his own eyes. And so there's basically an imperative is a command kind of thing, answer or do not answer, plus an object, the fool, and then the manner, according to his folly. And the negative then comes after that, the imperfect, with the consequence, lest you be like him, or lest he be wise in his own eyes. Walkie also picks up some assonance in here, that there's this sound thing going on with this verse as well, these verses, and so that's a beautiful, just kind of a poetic thing that's going on there that makes this really beautiful. Now, the fool. It's interesting that the fool, you say, well, Proverbs talks all about the fools, and so putting two fool verses next to each other, that isn't a pair, that's just random, it just happened and stuff. Fool, this Casiel type fool, there's several different types of fools. Marv Wilson in his book, Our Father Abraham, outlines the different three or four types of different fools. Here it's the word Casiel, which is the real fool, strongly. And there's 48 times it's used in Proverbs. Proverbs is 31 chapters, 49 times. So that's what, about two fools per chapter kind of thing. Some have more than that. But notice in Proverbs chapter 26, out of the 49 times, 11 times it has the word Casiel in our verses. 11 times, which is 22% of the word Casiel, occur in Proverbs chapter 26, verses 1 to 12 and things. In other words, this chapter is the fool chapter kind of thing. If you want to learn about fools, Proverbs 26 is where to go. According to his folly, only occurs two times in the whole book of Proverbs. So you say, well, just, you know, according to his folly, that could be anywhere in Proverbs. No, you know, according to his folly only occurs two times in the book of Proverbs, and that's in chapter 26, verse 4, and chapter 26, verse 5. You can't tell me that that's just luck that they got put back to back. No, no. According to his folly, only two times in the whole book, and they're put back to back like that. So these things are drawing together. Answer, the word answer, anah, is a low-frequency word. It's only used eight times in the book of Proverbs. So eight times in 31 chapters. And notice chapters 26, 4, and 5, those two verses, anah, to answer a fool or not answer a fool, are put back to back. That word answer is only used eight times, and two of those eight times is used in our two verses put back to back. The notion of lest or pen is used 17 times, and often it's in the initial line and 10 times in the second line. But notice then, our two, we're down to what's less than 17 times, and seven of those are in the initial line, so they aren't the same. But there are 10 that are similar, so 10 times pen is used. But notice it's used in out of the whole 10 times, and three, so it's used once every three chapters like this, once every three chapters, and yet ours is back-to-back, proverb to proverb, in the second line, both of them, lest he be like him, or lest he be wise in his own eyes. Now, I want to separate, you say, okay, you've got Proverbs chapters 4 and 5, and what I'm trying to show is the literary cohesion, that those things go together. Obviously, they go together. I've kind of, you know, beat a dead horse, so to speak. I mean, I've overdone it, but answer not a fool according to his folly, answer a fool according to his folly. Obviously, those verses go together, and I just proved that there's this major literary cohesion between those two verses. But now, is 4 and 5, is that separated from verse 3? In other words, is it a pair, or is it a triad? Is this other verse squeak in? No. Okay, it's interesting. Verse 3, 26:3 says, a whip for a horse, a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the back of fools. Now, that's very different than answering or not answering a fool. They're both about fools, but the whole section's about fools. Verse 12, 1 to 12 are about fools, but it's very different. A whip for the horse, a bridle for the donkey. Notice the kind of the comparison, a metaphor, whatever, and a rod for the back of fools. And so it's saying, you know, a whip, horse, bridle, this is for this is for this, and this is for this. And that's very different structure. While fools does link them all together, the topic is disciplining a fool, and 26:3 is disciplining a fool, not answering or reasoning with a fool, as it is in chapters 26:4 and 5. So notice also that in Proverbs 26:3, the verse preceding our verses, that it's and the rod for the backs of fools, plural. It's pluralized in chapter 26:3. In ours, do not answer a fool, singular. And so there's a distinction there. But one's talking about fools, plural. Our two verses are both singular in things. One is highly metaphorical, whip for the horse, bridle for the donkey. And so you get that kind of things going. So notice also that 26:3 is a tricolon, a whip for the horse, a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the back of fools. That's three lines. Three poetic lines. The lines in poetry are really important. Okay, I don't want to get off on that, but sometimes when you look at poetry, even when you see it in English, how do you tell poetry in the Old Testament? Because it's built line by line. Whereas when you get into historical narrative, the margins go down, you get whole paragraphs. The historical narratives are paragraph, paragraph, paragraph. In poetry, it's a line, it's a line, it's a line. And so the margins are zigzaggy in poetry all the time. In English, is how it comes over. All I'm trying to say is that there's a tricolon, three lines, and in our Proverbs, answer a fool according to a lest he be wise in his own eyes. Okay, there's two lines in both of those, and there's a tricolon, three lines there. So Proverbs 4 and 5, 26, 4 and 5, do not go with verse 3. There's a separation there, very different verses saying different things. Now, what about the verse that follows? 4 and 5 is followed by 6. Verse 6 goes like this. Like cutting off one's feet or drinking violence is sending a message by the hand of fools. Notice that this is a simile. Like cutting off one's feet or drinking violence is sending a message by the hand of a fool. It's using a simile. Well, there's no simile. You know, answer fool according to his folly, lest he be wise. There's no simile or things like that there. So it's quite different. And by the way, 6 does connect more down with 7 and 8 than it does back up. Okay. Here's a warning against using a fool to accomplish a task, not trying to reason with them. So verse 6 says how you shouldn't use a fool to accomplish a task, could not go and get done. Okay, but trying to correct him by reasoning is more 4 and 5 in answering a fool or not answering a fool. So the fool in 26:6 is positioned last, not in the first colon. Answer not a fool according to his folly. Answer a fool. Those are both in the first line, not in the second line. And in this one here in 26:6, the next verse, the fool comes in the second line, not the first. So just those differences, I think, are higher. So basically, chapter 26, verses 1 to 12, verse 2 is the only exception, addresses the fool. And so this is 26:4 and 5, then, is definitely a unit that stands out by itself, not with verse 6 and following, and not with verse 3. It's a pair. In other words, it's a pair. It's uniquely bonded together and is a pair. Now, what significance is the putting of these two together and strongly linking Proverbs back to back? Sometimes it may be worth it to risk personal risk to stop a fool from moving downward, being wise in his own eyes. What's worse than being a fool? Worse than being a fool is being wise in your own eyes. Arrogance, pride. There's no escape. Okay, there is escape redemptively, and I understand that, but it's worse than being a fool, being wise in your own eyes. And if you can stop the fool from descending into being wise in his own eyes, then it may be worth taking on some personal risk. But you have to, you know, watch out for that, because you can be damaged. Higher order reasoning is achieved by the apparent contradiction between the two proverbs. When and why should a person answer a fool? When and why? You got one proverb says don't answer a fool, the other one says answer a fool. When and why should that happen? And again, we said that this conflict then caused the book of Proverbs to be questioned whether it should even be in the canon. Now, what's interesting to me, and this is a side point, I'm sorry it's so small and stuff, and let me do this quickly. The Greek version, the Septuagint, which was done about 250 BC to 100 BC, basically the Jews started speaking Greek, and Alexander took over in 333 BC. Alexander the Great, or Great, comes through, turns everything Greek, Hellenistic, and things like that. So the Jews start speaking Greek. And so the New Testaments could be written in Greek, not Hebrew, largely because of what Alexander did, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And the Jews didn't have they had a Bible in Hebrew and Aramaic, but they didn't have one in Greek. So what happened is some Alexandrian Jews got together and said, hey, we need to translate our Hebrew Old Testament, Masoretic text. Okay, there's all sorts of conflicts. But it was our Hebrew text into the Septuagint text, into the Greek. So we take the Hebrew, we translate into Greek, and they called it the Septuagint then. The Septuagint was the Bible of basically in Jesus' time and Paul and things like that, and things cite the Greek Bible and stuff like that. So what happens when the scribes in Alexandria, when they translated the book of Proverbs, what you begin to see happening is that whenever they came into these proverbs that conflicted, they kind of softened the blow in their translation. So these guys, about 250 BC to 100 BC, they're translating the Bible from Hebrew and Aramaic into Greek, and when they do that, they soften the contradictions. You can just see Aristotle, classical Greek, contradictions, and the Bible's crazy, stuff like that. So they softened them in the Greek, okay, so different attitudes. And what I want to do is just take some on bribes and just show you in the Septuagint and how they softened up the bribes and this thing. So Proverbs 17:23 says this: the wicked accepts a bribe in secret to pervert the ways of justice. Bribes are no good. Judges should not accept bribes, okay? I still remember when I taught in prison for about 10 years in Michigan City Prison up in Indiana, in the maximum security prison there one day I said to the guys who were in the prison, that's a maximum security, so they're there. Many of those guys are there for their life. And I said, and it's nice in America that our judges don't accept bribes. And the guys in the class literally laughed at me. They said, Hildebrand, you got no clue. And these guys were more experienced in the world, and I think they were right in a lot of ways. But anyways, bribes are no good. Justice and bribes are supposed to be separated, okay, if you go back into Deuteronomy. It says explicitly this one thing the judges are not supposed to do is bribe. So the wicked accepts a bribe in secret to pervert the ways of justice. Proverbs 21:14 in the Hebrew text says, a gift in secret averts anger, and a concealed bribe strong wrath. In other words, if you want to avoid anger and somebody getting really mad at you, a gift, a bribe, can kind of smooth that over. But then you've got this problem with what do you do with bribes and stuff. So what happens is in the Greek Septuagint, it goes a secret gift, meaning generosity. So rather than using this term to say bribe, it's used to say gift in terms of generosity. A secret generosity turns away anger, and he who forbears giving raises strong wrath. Raises strong wrath. Okay. And so the whole point of this, and I don't want to go through all this, I think it's going to be too long, we've already gone too long and stuff, is that when they came to this thing of, are bribes good or bad? Well, in some contexts, they pervert justice, and that's evil and things. But then other passages say that a bribe or a gift actually can smooth things out, and it's appropriate to kind of grease the palm, you know. You got to get into the site at Jericho, and your guy sees all your cameras, and he won't let you in there really doing that. And so, you know, your friend pops him $10, and all of a sudden, shoom, you're in the site and things like that. Well, that worked pretty well. Didn't pervert just, well, I don't know what it did. But anyways, we got in there largely because we greased the guy's palm. So you got to know what the deal is. And so the Septuagint, it's interesting. The Septuagint realized these conflicts in terms of bribes, and they softened the blow and things. We're going to see they did the same thing with Proverbs chapter 26, 4 and 5. Hatton concludes, after examining the divergences between the Hebrew and the Greek Septuagint, my contention that the Greek version of Proverbs is sensitive to these spiky, contradictory nature of the Hebrew text and repeatedly translates it in a way that smooths out the contradictions could be a valuable hermeneutical device in identifying similar complexities in other scriptures. In other words, when they did it, they saw these conflicts, they smoothed it out. By attending to complex dialogues in the book, by refusing to jump to premature conclusions, by reading sensitively and holding contradictions together. And so what Hatton is saying is, no, you don't try to smooth them out. Don't try to harmonize, okay? By forcing them, smoothing them out and harmonizing, you're missing the point of interpreting each one to their own and letting them and to feel the tension that you need to really understand the nuances of what's going on. Holding contradictions together rather than seeking to harmonize them away, the reader can become one of those who is able to react wisely, responsibly in a complex world. Well said. Now, here are some solutions. There's a guy named Van Herden who wrote an article on the strategies applied by interpreters of the paradox in Proverbs 26, 4, and 5. And I got a hold of this. And he uses some of these proverbium people not, this is outside the Bible. They study Proverbs, international Proverbs. Meter was one. This Norick is another. And he says there's basically three ways when you got Proverbs that contradict each other. You know, look before you leap. He who hesitates is lost. Okay. Absence makes the heart go fonder, or out of sight, out of mind. Okay, these proverbs that clash with one another. He says how people solve that is they use, number one, separating frames of reference. Okay, they separate frames of reference, different situations. So you say, well, wait, one is for one situation, the other is for another situation. And then you describe which situation works for which proverb. So separating frames of reference. Sometimes these clashes call for kind of an averaging of the two proverbs. So, for example, she's awake and she isn't. She's awake and she isn't. Okay, it's like a contradiction. She's awake and she isn't. So what you do is you average the two together to make it, what's happening is she's awake but she isn't. In other words, she's just getting up, okay? And so she's in the process of waking. She's in between. And so you take two proverbs that contradict each other, and you kind of go for that middle, in the middle kind of thing, and you say they both combine together, like she's just waking up, okay? The averaging of opposites and making them come together. Another way to solve this problem, so one way is separating frames of reference or situations. One is averaging two together and combining them that way. The other one is modifying one term. So you take the term and you redefine it. So for example, a friend to everyone is a friend to no one. A friend to everyone is a friend to no one. Now what's that mean? Friend is being used in two different ways. And so what happens is, while it looks like a contradiction, it's not really. A friend to everyone is a friend to no one. Okay, friend is being used in a different way there. On the first term, a friend to everyone is kind of like a superficial friend, knows how to schmooze and go around and stuff. He's everybody's friend and things like that. But there's very different friend as being for a kind of a best friend forever kind of thing, where the person is really close, you're really close friends. And a friend who has friends with everybody, A friend to everyone is a friend to no one. No, isn't that close, a real friend. See how they're a friend being used in two different ways. And so modifying how the terms are used and things. And then the last one he points out is this vicious cycle. A vicious cycle. You get a conflict of two proverbs, and it creates a vicious cycle. So, for example, nothing is certain but uncertainty. Nothing is certain but uncertainty. It's, you see, it almost contradicts itself. Nothing is certain but uncertainty. And what this does is it creates a vicious cycle. Nothing is certain but uncertainty, but then uncertainty is certain. So therefore, and it creates this kind of cycle, you know. Can God make a rock too big that he can't pick it up? You know, if a tree falls in the woods, nobody hears it. Does it make a sound? Okay, those kind of things that creates this vicious cycle kind of thing. And what he says is that that's used for an emphatic function. Okay, nothing is certain but uncertainty is a way of, because of the clash, making an emphasis and emphasizing something, a vicious circle. So those are four ways. And now let's take, for example, these spheres of references. And I want to use next a book by Michael Fox, who's probably written one of the best commentaries on Proverbs ever written, two volumes on, by Michael Fox. Excellent. University of Wisconsin. Excellent scholar. He went back and said, here's how the rabbis used to solve this problem. They say, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. They say, don't answer back in matters of Torah, but only in matters of ordinary affairs. So that's how they take two separate situations. They say, if it's about Torah, don't argue about Torah like that. Okay, but if it's about ordinary affairs, okay, then you can argue like that, okay? And that's from some of the rabbis. Now, another way that they've taken it, Sadia, is don't answer back in mundane affairs, but only in religious matters. So this guy takes it and flips it. He says, don't answer in mundane affairs, but only in religious affairs. The Shabbat 30, section B, said, answer a fool in Torah, but in mundane answer, don't answer. This guy says, answer in mundane things, but in religious things, then answer. Okay, don't answer in mundane things. So they reverses the order there. And you say, ay, 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 oy vey. Don't answer when the audience knows both you and the fool. Okay, this comes from the Midrash on Proverbs. Don't answer when the audience knows both you and the fool. Answer when neither of you are known. Okay, so in other words, you don't avoid damage because they don't know you, and so then you can answer and stuff. The Midrash Proverbs there. Don't answer if by answering you are put on the same plane as the fool. Answer back when the fool is claiming the same status as the wise man. Fox says all these suggestions of trying to separate the different spheres with Torah and mundane and Torah, he said that they're all arbitrary and they're not derived from the text. They're all arbitrary and not derived from the text, and I think he's probably onto something there. Separating spheres of reference. Let me read Seidel, who's another of these paremiologists, okay, who study Proverbs, and there's a whole discipline, the paremiology kind of study. He contends that proverb meaning depends on the social context of the proverb use. Proverb use. Factors determining the relationship between the proverb and the user and the addressee, plus one's understanding of the proverbial situation, the relation between the parts of the proverb, plus one's understanding of the social situation, the relationship between the parts of the social situation, how it fits with the proverb, plus an assessment of the analogy between the proverb situation and the social situation, not to mention the rhetorical strategy applied by the user. Fox then looks at Proverbs 26:4-5, saying, 26:5 is the last word. So Fox privileges, it says, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Fox says the last word is given in verse 5, so therefore he privileges verse 5. Says, yeah, verse 4, yes, but verse 5 is the privileged one, is the majority advice. And the verse preceding is the minority. Interesting, Van Leeuwen reverses that and says, verse 4 is the majority. Answer, do not answer according to his folly. That's the majority one. That's what you should do most of the time. But if in some rare cases you see him getting wise in his own eyes, then do the minority report. So Fox and Van Leeuwen take different one. Fox emphasizes the fifth verse, and Van Leeuwen the fourth verse, and privileges those. Walke rejects the privileging approach, saying both are always true. To be sure, there is a time to be silent and a time to speak. Ecclesiastes 4 and 5. Excuse me. But one must always, not only in certain situations, answer a fool to destabilize him, but always, not sometimes, without becoming like him. So Walke tries to have both of them and affirm both the truth of both of them, and putting the saying, there's a time to answer a fool, a time not to, and make some good sense there. Does not seem like verse 4, the focus is on, the way I would look at it is according to the pronouns, and I'm going back to the grammar. The first one says, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. So the first one seems to be focusing on the damage that it does for you. So I want to say, damaging yourself, if that's the concern, in the situation, and you see that you're going to be damaged, then you need to take that into account. The second verse says, answer according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. So the second one is directed more at the fool. And if you're more concerned about the fool, he's becoming wise in his own eyes, then you need to put him in his place. You need to answer him. Okay? So one is, if you're looking at damage done to you, then don't answer. If the answers you see that you're trying to help him, then answer the fool according to his folly. And that's based off the you and the he and the pronouns in the second line there. And I kind of like that myself. That's the way I would go. Now, this rules, but if a fool continues to pester you in verse 5, then response is necessary. So he says, yeah, don't answer a fool according to his folly, but if he pesters you and pesters you and pesters you, then answer, and lest he be wise in his own eyes. Now, another way is taking the averaging of opposites. So the first one says, basically, there are certain times and certain situations when you answer full, and there are certain times in which you don't answer full, certain situations you don't answer full. I agree with that, and it depends where your focus is and whether it's toward him or toward yourself and the image. But so that's separating two situations. Averaging opposites. Now, Van Huren takes Wybrae and McCain as holding each proverb encompasses only partial truth. So answer a fool according to his folly, do not answer, each are partial and must be taken together to get the fuller picture. So you need both proverbs to fill out the whole picture. And so this is kind of like averaging the both together and having your cake and eating too. Sounds like a proverb to me. Having your cake and eating too, putting them both together, and that together they present the fuller picture. And there's an element of truth to that, the complete picture and stuff. Now, word modification is an interesting one too. And the Septuagint is very interesting. Translate this, like, and you will be like him yourself. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. And then the other one, lest he be wise in his own eyes. There's a difference between this ka, which is the Hebrew word for la. It's used both times. It's translated like or as, but in Greek, when they bring it over, one time it's translated pros, which is to, and kata is like according to. So it's according to his folly. The first one is, do not answer a fool according to his folly. And the second verse then is, answer a fool as his folly deserves. And so the Septuagint then, by using pros and kata, these prepositions, do not answer a fool according to his folly, pros, but the next verse says, answer a fool, kata, as his folly deserves. And so they basically smooth it out between whether he deserves to be answered or not, and the Septuagint. The NASB Bible, by the way, translates the first verse, according to his folly, and the second verse translates it, as his folly deserves. So the NASB then picks up that distinction, even though the word in Hebrew is ka in both situations, and translates it two different ways. Same word, translated two different ways. Bullman takes the word ana, answer, and translates it two different ways. Ana can also be translated to humble or rebuke. So the first verse would then read, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly." Excuse me. The second verse would be translated, "Rebuke a fool, lest he become wise in his own eyes." So the word "ana," answer, then, is translated "answer" in the first one, don't answer him, but rebuke him in the second line. And the word "ana" is translated differently than in those two different situations. I'm not sure I like either of these. And by the way, the Today's English version says, if you answer a silly question, and the second one is, give a silly answer to a silly question. And so they tried to, even Today's English version tries to change the meanings of the words, which are the same words. So I like Mitre and the Parmenologists' approach that such proverb dueling is part of the genre. In other words, these clashing proverbs is just part of the proverbs that occurs in, we saw in Sumerian, in Yoruba, in Nigeria, in English, all over the place. And so, genre found almost universally in proverbial collections and citations. It sparks higher order thinking. When you get the clash, then you've got to say, how do these proverbs fit together? And it creates higher order thinking, interpretive insights, proverbial playfulness. And I'm sorry, we always take the Bible so sincere, you know, so sterilely and so seriously that you don't realize that sometimes the Proverbs are just having fun and playfulness, imagination and reflection, and those types of things with imagination and reflection. Those are important in Proverbs in general. Proverbs' relation to the truth. It's not propositional truth. Proverbs are not presenting universal propositional truth, okay? They're basically making small statements about specific situations and stuff and can be applied in multiple situations and not these universal truths and stuff. Now, the clash of two Proverbs gives way to insight. What is your purpose in dealing with this fool's question? What is your purpose? There is a time to answer and a time not to answer. Depends on the situation. It's not a universal or absolute truth. Proverb is not a promise. But what is a proverb and what is its authority? What is its authority? It's not a universal authority. It's in a particular situation that the authority comes to bear. The pronoun you will become like him, or he will be wise in his own eyes, seems to trigger. The first one is concerned about damage to yourself, and the second one, damage to him, or the fool. Wisdom, discernment, is the hermeneutic, and basically in chapter 26, verses 1 to 12, it's asking, what is fitting for a fool? What is fitting for a fool? And there's not a symbol formula, there's not a logarithm that you can just plug this into. Life is complex, and the sole proverb only gives you one aspect. Yeah, even the fool is quoting proverbs, okay? So you can't say that these things are always, a fool can quote a proverb and do some really dumb things with the proverb. So you got to be careful, even when he's quoting something that's a proverb. And so the pair shows the complexity. The clashing of the pair shows the complexity of the life and things, and you've got to work with that. Why this pair? Imagination, pedagogical, hermeneutical, and interpretive, that you've got to interpret these proverbs. Insightful, to gain insight. Playful, there may be some clash, and the sage who is saying these proverbs just got a smile on his face because he realized he just gave you two proverbs that clash against each other, and he smiles and looks at you. What are you going to do with that? You know, you're the student. What are you going to do with that? Do you go one side and not the other? Do you try to put them both together? How do you solve the conundrum? And the sage looks and just smiles because he's going to see the student wrestling with it, knowing when and how and what is fitting to address a fool. The importance of pairs in providing proverbial dialogic setting by the editor. The editor is setting it up so that the sage and the student, there's a dialogue going on. Now, the sum is greater than the individual parts. All I'm trying to say is these two proverbs are put together, and the sum of them is greater than the individual parts. Each proverb has its own wisdom, yes, but when seen together, the wisdom demands higher order thinking about situations and life's complexity is called upon from the student. Purposeful, juxtaposition composing of by the editors is not random. This is not random. That these two proverbs were put together, these are a pair, put together to be a pair, to be interpreted as a pair and stuff. They're not, they are individual proverbs. You can take them individually, but putting together as a pair, it forms a new level of meaning, okay? A new level of meaning, the editorial level of meaning of the canonical biblical text. Methodologically, when reading Proverbs, look at the one before and look at the one after. Whenever you read a sentence proverb, look at the one before and the one after to see if there's any connections there that's going to modify how you interpret the proverb you're working with. So pairs, triads, strings, or clusters. You need to look for pairs, single proverbs, yes, but pairs, see how they're paired, triads, strings, clusters, those types of things, and look at repetitional variations intertextually and things. Van Leeuwen's, to bring this kind of to a close, Van Leeuwen summarizes wonderfully, quote, wisdom does not always mean doing the same thing, even in superficially similar circumstances. Yet the juxtaposition of these admonitions drives one to reflect on the limits of human wisdom. The limits of human wisdom. For no clue is given to help the reader identify which fool should be ignored and which spoken to. Of two viable courses of action, we do not always know which one is fitting. What's the purpose of chapter 26, 1 to 12? What is fitting for a fool? How do you deal with it? And then Hoagland concludes, to enter into dialogue with the fool is both an obligation, lest he be wise in his own eyes, and a threat to the wise. It's an obligation, lest he be wise in his own eyes, and a threat, lest you be like him yourself, to the wise. So this dialogue with the fool has ramifications. You've got to look at it carefully. Thus, Proverbs chapter 26, verse 4 and 5, for a proverb pair, intentionally concatenated, put together, to push the wise toward higher order thinking, imagination, using the proverbial pair with its repetition and with a certain amount of playfulness and parody to accomplish the editor's purpose of thinking more deeply about what is fitting in dealing with a fool. Thank you so much. I realize this has been long, but hopefully it's been wonderful as you see these proverbs clash and you see the biblical editor kind of pushing people to think more deeply about what is the response to someone who's a fool, and when is the time to answer, when is the time not to, and how to, and gaining insight and things. Now, I just want to run through some resources, and we'll conclude with this. Is resources, anybody who studies Proverbs, let me just give you, there are three major commentaries on Proverbs that are wonderful. One's a guy named Bruce Waltke, two volumes, Erdman's, beautiful set, wonderful Proverbs teaching, Bruce Waltke. Incredible. Michael Fox is also one of the leading biblical proverbial scholars in the world. And he's got two volumes in the Anchor Bible Dictionary. So those two, Waltke and Fox, Michael Fox, Bruce Waltke, amazing. Bruce Waltke, by the way, did a series on Psalms. If you're interested in biblical e-learning, he did a series of 28 lectures on the book of Psalms. By the way, he's an expert in Hebrew poetry. A Harvard PhD. So anyways, Michael Fox and Bruce Waltke, those are the two seminal, incredible works on that. Steinman also has a wonderful commentary on it and stuff. I think I've got it here. Actually, let me just see. Actually, here's Waltke's. Here's a picture of Waltke's book and then Fox's book as well on that. These are two volumes. I just got the one volume. Steinman's got this book on Proverbs, which is also an excellent work. And then, lest I forget, one that I kind of grew up with and things is Derek Kidner's book on Proverbs. Real small book, put out by InterVarsity Press, but just a wonderful little treatment of Proverbs and things. So those, Hatton's Contradiction to the Book of Proverbs, been very helpful. Mitre's book, Wolfgang Mitre. Anybody who studies Proverbs, I wish the biblical people could plug more strongly into the proverbium movement and the paremiologists who are studying Proverbs internationally. He's got a book called The Wisdom of Many, Essays on the Proverb. Well worth reading. Twisted, he has another book called Twisted Wisdom, Modern Anti-Proverbs. And this is where he gets 300 proverbs and shows how they clash each other and how they are twisted in various ways. It's wonderful. Knut Heim also has an article on Proverbs chapter 26, verses 1 to 12, a crash course on the hermeneutics of Proverbs. And then Knut Heim also is a wonderful guy. He did a series, actually, in this. If you look just above me in Biblical E-Learning, he's got a book, Poetic Magic Imagination in Proverbs, Variation, Repetitions, and the Nature of Poetry. Wonderful book. He does a wonderful series of lectures, and it's really great. Van Herden has an article that he did in 2008, Strategies Applied by Interpreters of the Paradox in Proverbs 26, 4, and 5 in the Journal of Semitics, volume 17.2 in 2008. And that Hoagland also. This book here is a little bit older now. It's called Learning from the Sages, Selected Studies in the Book of Proverbs by a guy named Roy Zuck. Roy Zuck was at Dallas Seminary. Wonderful book. Culls major articles up to the time this book was written and major articles on wisdom, Proverbs in particular here. And Roy Zuck's book on that is very good, a good collection and things like that. Well, thank you so much. And I hope you can think more deeply today about to answer a fool according to his folly. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. May we not be wise in our own eyes. But humility and the fear of God leads to wisdom. And so that's our first pair. Now, in our next lecture, we're going to go over four other pairs where I'll try to show you how those pairs are connected. It's much more sophisticated linguistically and otherwise, but we'll go over the four other pairs, and that will complete this two lectures or a pair of lectures on the proverbial pair. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his teaching on proverb pairs and the Proverbs 26, 4 and 5, quote, contradiction, end quote. Session 1. To answer or not to answer a fool? That is the question.